to all people. It's always the age-old question here, do we take Gordon's advice or not? I mean, Mr. Hanaway, let me have a little respect here. First, just wanted to say hello to everyone from the folks in the Front Range Colorado congregations. That's Denver, north of there to Loveland, and south of there to Colorado Springs, as well as another congregation in Frisco, which is up in the mountains, just west of there, that we meet once a month as well. But it has become a tradition now for them to say hello to you, and they just love hearing hello back. So if I could, hello. Okay, I'm going to let them know that you participate much more than they do. I'm just kidding. No, just wanted to say hello. By way of introduction to the sermon today, I had recently seen something. Actually, there's a gentleman named Robert Pigeot. He's a religious affairs correspondent for the British Broadcasting Corporation. He had written this article, and it's titled "Motion to End Bible Oaths in Court Defeated." And that's "Motion to End Bible Oaths in Court Defeated." And it was published in the UK section of the BBC News, again, very recently. And what the article did is it referred to the Magistrates Association. Now, the Magistrates Association, they deal with the judges and the protocols in the court system in the England and Wales, you know, how things are done, that sort of thing. And they debated a motion that was set forth by one of those magistrates. And basically, the motion was to replace how an oath is sworn in court by witnesses and defendants. And perhaps we've all heard this phrase or something like it, whether in television or if you happen to have been in a courtroom. You don't have to shoot short of hands for a courtroom here. But they would say something to this effect: I swear by Almighty God to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And how it's done while they're either holding a Bible, perhaps in both of their hands, or placing their hand upon it. It's commonly done. Well, this motion, again, it sought to replace the swearing of the oath by asking witnesses or defendants to just simply promise. Just promise to very sincerely tell the truth. Well, supporters of the motion argue that many people have become indifferent to the Bible, that swearing to God or on the Bible no longer compelled people to tell the truth. Rather, what needed to be done was a greater emphasis on how seriously lying in court is treated. You know, the penalties associated with perjury. So instead of swearing by God, put the fear of God in them that if they lie, they're going to be in serious trouble. You need a different direction. Well, the magistrates thought otherwise. They thought that referencing God and the Bible strengthened the value of the witness's testimony. That it's a moral force, if you will, placed intense pressure on witnesses to actually tell the truth. So they did not agree on this, and so the motion was defeated. Already the courts of England and Wales, they accommodate oaths taken on other books, Muslims, for example, on the Quran, Jews on the Old Testament, if they so prefer to do it that way, and atheists are allowed to simply solemnly, sincerely, and truly affirm the words used there, instead of actually swearing the Bible and swearing before God. So in the courts of England and Wales, people will continue, at least for now, to swear an oath on the Bible should they choose to do so. Similarly, the courts in the United States, a witness or a defendant is asked to swear that they will tell the truth. They can take, or may take, a sacred oath that binds their conscience, for example, by swearing, you know, on a Bible, or they may affirm or promise to tell the truth without religious belief. They have that option. You know, we kind of live in an interesting world where truth can sometimes be a very challenging thing to get to. Challenging thing. It's all too often the first casualty between people who interact with one another. We have an incredibly elaborate system. Lawyers, contracts, notaries, binding signatures, these sorts of things, to ensure that we will do what we say we're going to do. We have that, at least when it's perceived to be important enough. But does it really make people any more truthful? Does it? One of the enduring themes of the scriptures of our Bible is this concept of truth, pure truth. And we read in places like John 17 and verse 17, sanctify them by your truth. Your word is truth. Your word is truth. So truth matters. Truth matters a big deal. It is a big deal in our Bibles. God shows it to be a big deal. And our telling of it is a very big deal as well. So with that in mind for the sermon time today, we're going to take some time to review a framework, a biblical framework for telling the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And specifically, we're going to do that in the context of keeping our promises, our word, and that our word matters, that our word matters, and that we are people of our word. But more importantly, that the truth be at the heart of who we are. It's who we are, that there isn't a separation of truth and who we are, and that truth is a fundamental demonstration of a very, very important godly characteristic. Let's go ahead and begin by turning to Genesis 28. Genesis 28, we're going to look at one of the ways promises were often made, form of them typically being that of vows or that of oaths, read in Scripture. And here we're going to see an example of Jacob and him making a vow. So Genesis 28, we'll go ahead and turn to verses 20 and 22 of Genesis chapter 28. And it reads, then Jacob made a vow, saying, if God will be with me and keep me in this way that I am going, and give me bread to eat and clothing to put on, so that I come back to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God. And this stone, which I have set as a pillar, shall be God's house. And of all that you give me, I will surely give you a tenth to you. Well, the word vow here is nadar. It's nadar. It's spelled N-A-D-I-R. And it simply means to promise. It means to promise to do or give something to God. To promise to do or give something to God. When we speak of an oath, you know, it too is a promise between someone with another. But a vow here is special, and here's why. It's not only a promise, like an oath is. This is a promise to God. It's entered between man and God. So again, a vow is a promise. It's a promise to God, to God. Let's go ahead and turn now to Numbers chapter 30. Numbers chapter 30. We're just going to look a little closer at what makes up or what constitutes, if you will, an oath or a vow. And really, what does that bring? What obligation does that bring with it? We're just going to turn to Numbers chapter 30 and in verse 2. If a man makes a vow to the Lord or swears an oath to bind himself by some agreement, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth. And the word swears here and the word oath are actually the same word in Scripture, Hebrew words called Shabbah. And it literally means to seven oneself, like the number seven. Of course, we know seven is symbolic in Scripture of completion and perfection. So what he does here, a Shabbah is a promise to fulfill a promise. A promise to promise. And the idea is that the promise is complete. And the promise is without question. And swearing an oath here is also an appeal. It's an appeal to God as a witness to the truthfulness of the statement. They're asking God to declare that what they are saying is true. Actually doing that. Which of course means that swearing falsely was to represent God as taking on a, or supporting, shall I say, a false statement or a lie. You know, if that happens, of course, that would need to be repented of. And we read in places like Leviticus chapter 19 and verse 12, which says, you shall not swear by my name falsely, nor shall you profane the name of your God, I am the Lord. So part of what's going on here is that someone who makes the promise, they make the promise like this, they need not only to be sure that they're going to fulfill it and make sure that it's true, but also make sure that they are not doing anything or asking God to attest to anything that would be untrue in any way or wrong. or sinful. Big responsibility. So Numbers 30, verse 2 also shows us that, you know, someone who may make a promise, and may declare a promise, may make a vow, and whether that promise is in writing or not, whether it is in writing or not, it's binding. It's binding according to all that's been said. If it comes out of the mouth, then it's binding on the one who promises it. I'm just going to go ahead and just read this here, and you can turn there if you want. But Deuteronomy chapter 23, verses 21 through 23. I'm going to read this and another verse here in a little bit with the New International Version. Turn there if you wish. Again, Deuteronomy 23, 21 through 23, and it reads as follows. If you make a vow to the Lord your God, do not be slow to pay it. For the Lord your God will certainly demand it of you, and you will be guilty of sin. But if you refrain from making a vow, you will not be guilty. Whatever your lips utter, you must be sure to do, because you made your vow freely to the Lord your God with your own mouth. To add to this, there was one other one I wanted to just refer to here, just to bring a little more clarity to this. It's in Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 4 through 6. And it's Ecclesiastes 5, 4 through 6. Again, I'm going to read this from the New International Version as well. And it says, when you make a vow to God, do not delay to fulfill it. He takes no pleasure in fools. Fulfill your vow. It is better not to make a vow than to make one and not fulfill it. Do not let your mouth lead you into sin. And do not protest to the temple messenger, my vow was a mistake. Why should God be angry at what you say and destroy the works of your hands? So these vows, they're a promise. It's a promise to God. A promise. And often it takes on the form of some kind of offering. God bless them in a certain way, and it comes in the form of an offering. But they are voluntary. They are made voluntarily. But a vow once made must be kept. Must be kept. If it comes out of the mouth, whether someone else hears it or not, the promise is binding. Of course, the real test is whether God heard it. And if so, God says He's not going to delay. He's not going to delay here. You have to. He's saying you do not delay in fulfilling it. Don't delay. Call a story of a husband and wife who decided that if God would help them sell a particular property they had, they've been having difficulty selling it. I mean, for long years, they just couldn't get any movement on it. And even though the property was to be sold at an amount much less than what they paid for it, it's just a bad timing for property. They made a vow. They made a vow to God that if it would sell, they would pay it. And the vow was not contingent, in this case, on them getting a specific amount for the property. They didn't make that as part of their vow. But sure enough, God did bless their request. The property did sell. And they paid their vow, and there's no question in their mind that God's hand was behind it to help them sell it. I also know someone who made a similar promise as it relates to a new business he was starting. And the promise was, the vow was based on if God would provide a certain number of new customers, which for him meant contracts for his business, if he would do that for him, he would vow a certain amount to give to the church, to God. And sure enough, actually in this case, he did get customers. Actually more than he ever asked for. But unlike the other example, he struggled in making good on his vow. He kept changing the terms, delayed paying it. Oh, surely God will allow me to reinvest this and grow it more, surely. Well, in the end, it did not go well for him. He lost his business, actually, ultimately. You know, how God decides to bless or correct someone in this regard is His choosing. He's sovereign. Certainly the timing of that is up to Him. But these principles are very real. They're very real. For when a vow is made, it openly or indirectly appeals directly to God to witness and to sanction what has been promised, to sanction that, and to judge if the one vowing breaches what they promised to do. A promise is a promise, and God sees it all and He hears it all. Let's go and turn to Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5. throughout the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus focuses in on the spirit of the law, in keeping with the purpose of it as a reflection of God's holy character. And he, of course, talks about a very high standard, a higher standard than the letter of the law demonstrates. And he asks us that we reflect that higher standard, which is referred to, again, as the spirit of the law. Let's go ahead and pick it up in verse 33 of Matthew chapter 5. He says, "Again, you have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not swear falsely, but shall perform your oath to the Lord.' But I say to you, do not swear at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by the earth, for it is his footstool, nor by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Nor shall you swear by your head, because you cannot make one hair white or black. But let your yes be yes, and your no, no. For whatever is more than these is from the evil one." Now, there's some Christians who take these verses here to mean that we must not, under any circumstances, utter a vow or an oath. Some even refuse to take an oath in the marriage ceremony or actually in any other situation. But is that what is being taught here? Is that the point? Is this a change? Is this a change to the law? Is it something new? I mean, new to overcome the human tendency not to be truthful? Is it for that? You know, it's derived from the law as surely as the first two you have heard statements in the sermon earlier, where he said, "You shall not commit murder. You shall not commit adultery." You know, just to add some color here, earlier in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus was very, very clear about what it is he was teaching. Let's just go back up a little bit in Matthew chapter 5 and pick it up in verse 17. So familiar verses, but important in the context today. We'll read verses 17 through 20 of Matthew chapter 5. It says, "Do not think that I came to destroy the law or the prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For assuredly, I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, one jot or one tittle will by no means pass from the law till all is fulfilled. Whoever therefore breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches men so shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven." So by his own words, Jesus is not making a change to the law. He's not making a change. Even this word fulfill, it's called pleroo, actually. Spelled P-R-E-R-O-O. Pleroo is actually how it's done. And it actually means to verify. It means to verify or to make clear, to magnify, to make it clear. So what's the point, then, that he's emphasizing? And what exactly were some of the scribes and Pharisees doing that is mentioned here, and what exactly are we to do that's different than what it is that they did? Well, before we answer that question, let's go ahead and hold our place here in Matthew chapter 5, and let's turn over to James chapter 5. James chapter 5. Because James echoes these words of Jesus as he puts special emphasis on this command. Special emphasis. Actually, he introduces it with the words "above all." James chapter 5 and verse 12. And it says, "But above all, my brethren, do not swear, either by heaven or by earth, or with any other oath. But let your yes be yes, and your no, no, lest you fall into judgment." You fall into judgment. Okay, that word, judgment here, is hypocrisis. It means condemnation because of hypocrisy. So he's saying, don't fall into hypocrisy as it relates to this. Don't do that. Vine's dictionary actually had an interesting explanation of this as it relates specifically to Matthew chapter 5 and verse 33. I'm going to go ahead and quote here. If you happen to have Vine's complete expository dictionary, you can look it up on page 438 if you'd like to look there. But they made an interesting statement that shines a lot of light on this. And it says, "The Lord's command in Matthew 5:33 was a condemnation of the minute and arbitrary restrictions imposed by the scribes and Pharisees in the matter of adjurations, by which God's name was profaned. By the way, I had no idea what adjurations meant, so I had to look it up. It means a solemn oath. A solemn oath. So God's name was being profaned by how they administrated their oaths, somehow. You know, so what was that about? What was Jesus teaching here? Well, what he was addressing was a popular abuse of oaths in his day. In an attempt to protect God's name from being profaned by careless oath-breaking, the common practice was to introduce substitute objects by which to swear. So, for example, this is how you play it out. Some people thought it was apparently harmless to deceive someone if they swore an oath, say, by their right hand. That doesn't count. That's not a real oath, see? It's not a real one. And the idea was is that the farther removed the oath was from the actual name of God, the less danger they faced when violating it. And so what they did is they actually appointed people to arbitrate, had to decide which oaths were binding, which were not. Did someone infer God's name or didn't they? Is this real, is it not, or is it less than of an oath? And as Matthew 5:34-36 points out, instead of swearing by God, they would swear by heaven, by the earth, by Jerusalem. They'd even swear by their own heads. Let's go and turn to Matthew 23. It is as if oaths had almost become a competition to see who could bind the most impressive object to their statement to give them some kind of false credibility and force while not actually mentioning God. And Jesus speaks to just how out of control this had all become. Matthew 23:16-22. He says, "Woe to you, blind guides, who say whoever swears by the temple, it is nothing. But whoever swears by the gold in the temple, he is obliged to perform it. Fools and blind, for which is greater, the gold or the temple that sanctifies the gold? And whoever swears by the altar, it is nothing. But whoever swears by the gift that is on it, he is obliged to perform it. Fools and blind, for which is greater, the gift or the altar that sanctifies the gift? Therefore, he who swears by the altar swears by it and by all things on it. He who swears by the temple swears by it and by him who dwells in it. And he who swears by heaven swears by the throne of God and by him who sits on it." So you kind of see where this has been taken. And Jesus is just taking their logic and turning it upside down. Because they were just coming up with all sorts of creative mental acrobatics to insulate themselves from accountability. And Jesus clearly states that nobody can get away with doing that by invoking things because God is sovereign over everything. You can't hide. You can't do that. You can't swear by the temple to avoid speaking words of truth. It's the glory of God that makes the temple what it is. You can't swear by heaven to avoid being seen by God in your lies. Heaven is the very throne of God. So Jesus was teaching that all oaths invoke God as a witness. Just as heaven, earth, and Jerusalem belong to God, so do the hairs in our head. You know, although we can dye our hair, I mean, if we have hair to actually do that with, but can you genuinely control aging? Can we genuinely control making a hair white or black? We don't have that. And so what's at the very core of this teaching here is that oaths are a very poor substitute for integrity. And the point of these passages is that integrity. Since God witnesses everything we say and everything we do, we should be able to tell the truth without having to call God to witness by a formal oath. We shouldn't have to do that. And Jesus is using very forceful words with this in his teaching. You know, words that just kind of cut through so much. We're asked to discern the true reality of what it is that we speak. You know, words that compel us to think about things in a way we wouldn't otherwise think about. Yes is yes, no is no. What's between it is not from him. Let's read a passage here from Hebrews. refer to it here, Hebrews 4, 12 through 13. Again, you're welcome to turn there, but I just wanted to refer to it. And it says, "For the word of God is living and powerful, sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even the division of soul and spirit, and of joints and marrow, and is a discerner of the thoughts and the intents of the heart. And there's no creature hidden from his sight, but all things are naked and open to the eyes of him to whom we must give account." So God is saying, and the result of his word is to compel us to seek truth, to tell the truth, to be truthful in our minds and our hearts, to keep promises. And it clarifies another understanding that he sees everything. He understands truth perfectly. He sees truth perfectly. Remember a while back I was reviewing a particular draft of a written contract after an agreement was reached between two parties. Unfortunately, the contract draft was not what was agreed upon. The language contained in the document had a lot of things, but I guess I would just call it escape clause language in the agreement. Now, agreements are commonly crafted in such a way that there are such things as it's called quid pro quos. I mean, if I do something, you agree to do something, vice versa, that kind of thing. Well, this one was so loosely and so messy. It's like everything was defined in an obscure way. They had so many caveats in this thing: warnings, provisos, stipulations, conditions, limitations, things that just make your head spin. And on top of that, they had addendums in the back of the agreement, which are even more so documentation for the agreement itself. So you got 300 pages of basically legal gobbledygook. And if you go through it, at least for me anyway, I don't consider myself smart, but I could not figure it out. I just could not get to what they were trying to do. Because it just seemed to me that in looking at the agreement and reading it as a whole, that they were basically agreeing to do something that they felt like it. And that was about as far as it could go. I couldn't get to the truth of the document. At least I couldn't. What was their yes? What was their no? I was actually unsure. Actually, in this case, as it turns out, their purpose was not really to come to an agreement at all, but to just keep negotiations in play long enough for them to actually get a better deal from someone else. And so a lot of money, a lot of time invested in this. No contractual agreement was reached with us. And anyway, it just reminded me that, you know, in oaths, promises, agreements, all these kinds of things, or in this case, the process of the negotiation, as the story shows, are just nothing without integrity. They're just nothing. With that in mind, let's go ahead and just return again to Matthew chapter 5. I'm going to read the first part of verse 34 and then verse 37. It says, "But I say to you, do not swear at all." In verse 37. "But let your yes be yes, and your no, no. For whatever is more than these is from the evil one." So just to kind of summarize what we've talked about so far, you know, when you swore an oath to someone, you were appealing to that person as a witness to attest to your words and a judge against you. If your words were found to be untrue, you were using the name of someone whose witness is reliable and trustworthy to testify to the trustworthiness of what you said. When you do that, at the same time, you were acknowledging your accountability to that person, agreeing that you expected to be judged. You expected to be judged by him if you were found guilty of speaking falsely. That was your expectation. Which is why what we read in Hebrews 6, verse 16, it says, "Men swear by one greater than themselves." Because they are swearing to the one to whom they are accountable to. The one they're accountable to. And in Jesus' day, an interesting twist was put on all of this. They had trouble telling the truth, telling it consistently, as is common today. You know, so in order to guard themselves against being found guilty, against swearing falsely by the name of God, they kind of got into the habit of swearing by anything but God in order to attempt to get around it. They wanted to add some kind of force, though, to their promises to make their words seem credible. want to appear to be credible, but they did not want to incur the judgment of God by swearing something in His name when they didn't fully intend to make good on it, or when it was not entirely true. So they created what was in effect a lesser class of oaths, sub-oaths. We described in a lot of different ways. We might think of them in terms of half-truths, semi-truths, even white lies, escape clause commitments, that kind of thing. And my personal favorite, the fractional truth. Fractional truth. Maybe a little bit of truth in there. A little bit. Got to have enough to make you believe me. But not really. Not the real truth. And this, as Jesus referred to in Matthew 5:37, is from the evil one. He said, this is not from me. You play that middle ground? He said, that is not from me. It's not from me. And we read in places like John 8, verse 44, you know, about where departures from the truth really come from. Where does that come from? What's the source of that? Again, a verse that's familiar perhaps to all of us. I'm just going to refer to it here, and that's John 8:44. It says, you are of your father the devil, and desires of your father you want to do. He was a murderer from the beginning, and does not stand in the truth. He doesn't even have his foot in the truth in this regard, other than he may use it to manipulate. But he says there's no truth in him. No truth. When he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own resources, for he is a liar and the father of it. And to the point, Jesus teaches that there is only one class of truth. Only one. Only one class of promise. Everything else has some kind of lie as a part of it. Remember back in my college days, I had a bunch of friends I spent time with on the weekend whenever we had time, at least between quarters at college, that kind of thing. We'd go out and play football. We'd do all sorts of things and activities together. One thing, though, that was different, even though we had a lot in common, we were very different when it came to our driving habits. Some of us will, I'll just say we're a little more conservative, you know, at least when it comes to things like speed limits, using blinkers on the highway, and actually passing on the right side of the road, you know, that kind of thing. But others, other guys were kind of aggressive, some very aggressive. And one of them, we're just going to call his name Joe, for sake of anonymity. He was sort of a guy who thought of, you know, traffic rules as kind of a broad and loose suggestion that he didn't really need to follow. Anyway, on one particular day, and again, I'm not here to pick on Joe, as you know, I could easily use plenty of my own shortcoming examples in the course of time, but I thought this was interesting as it relates to the subject here. But Joe decided to pass somebody on the right on the road, and he's on a two-lane highway, 50-mile-an-hour speed limit going both ways, and the traffic, the oncoming traffic, just gave him no opportunity to do that. So Joe decides to pass on the right, on the shoulder of the road, which was illegal in that state. And he's going over 75 and 50. He's passing. He's got two wheels on the shoulder where the pavement is. He's got two wheels in the gravel and the grass. And he's weaving and swaying, fishtailing, and all those kinds of things as he's trying to get over. And he gets past this vehicle, and thankfully, he was able to gain control and get back on the road. Actually just before a bridge. So it's very important he did that. And, of course, exactly at the same time, a police officer was coming the other way. Well, the ticket he got, and indeed he got a ticket, it was for reckless driving. Reckless driving, and given his record of driving, it would have meant that he would lose his license, unless this particular ticket was at least reduced to what they call a negligent charge, which was a lesser charge. He'd still have a huge fine to pay, at least he'd be able to keep his driver's license. But in order to contest that, he had to go to court. So the court date arrived, and some of the guys accompanied him, you know, just to see what would happen. After all, someone may need to drive him home after that. He may not be legal to do that. When he got up to the stand, you know, and gets sworn in and stuff, even traffic court there, the judge knew him by his first name from the last time he was in court. And this interesting little dialogue, if you will, ensued between the judge and Joe. And it went something like this. I'm going to paraphrase a little bit here, but sort of like, I see you're here again visiting us, Joe. You know, yes, Your Honor. Joe, didn't you promise me last time that you would not be seeing me again in this fine court? And again, he's kind of trying to be humble. Yes, Your Honor, that's what I was hoping for. And yet you're here today. You're here today with a ticket for reckless driving, no less. You know, what exactly are you here for, and what do you have to say for yourself? Well, Joe starts to try to say something. The judge just basically stops him right there. He says, Joe, the officer's report shows. We have witnesses. You were going over 75 in a posted 50. You're passing a vehicle on the right. You almost lost control of your vehicle. What do you now want to say on your behalf? So Joe tried to muster as much control as he could, much clothed himself as much humility as he could try to possess. And he simply said, Your Honor, I just really want you to know, yes, that's all true, but I really was not in a reckless mood at the time. I was much more in a negligent mood. And then, with great passion, he tried to grovel and promise that the judge will never see him again. He's going to be a responsible driver this time. And we're all sitting in the back watching this, wondering, is the judge going to buy this? Actually, he ended up being lenient. Yeah, judge did, to our surprise, total surprise. Dropped it to a negligent charge. Had a heavy fine. Stiff warning. If you ever saw him again, that's it. Driver's license is revoked, period. You know, and for those of us who knew Joe, we didn't really think that his promises really held up to his intentions. He just kind of said whatever it took to buy time or to be able to get the judge, to be able to allow him to keep his license, to tell the judge what it is that the judge wanted to hear, whatever it took. And I believe he himself would admit as much if we were to corner him on it. Even though in the course of time, I'll just say that he learned his lesson to be a responsible driver in the course of time. And again, I'm not here whatsoever to pick on Joe. I mean, all of us in that group have done more than our fair share of falling short in this regard. But what was really, really interesting here is that when God talks about, you know, our yes being yes and our no being no, you know, and here it is, even in a court setting, a fractional promise was made, at best. Fractional. And it is so common in today's environment to see that. Partial promise. I'm going to tell somebody what I think they want to hear. I'm going to do that without any real regard to what the truth is. It happens all the time. I know in business it happens more than I care to see. And my point here is this, again, not to pick on Joe whatsoever, is that this is one of the slippery slopes that our adversary wants us to play in. Make your yes not quite your yes. Make your no not quite your no. Play in that environment. Rationalize. Compromise just a little. It's okay. It's for a better purpose, whatever it takes. It's not a problem. When Jesus here is saying no, Don't operate in there. Don't operate between the yes and the no. Don't do that. It's a high standard. It's a hard one. I mean, to really think through what you say and what we promise, and to really know that it is truth that we're saying and truth that we're promising and that our intentions are sure, it's a hard thing to do. You know, it does, though, of course, beg another question. What if your intentions are right? What if they are? What if you promise something and you fully intend to live up to it? If you have that, but something does come up. What if there is a change of plans? What if your yes is yes and your no is no? You're a person of your word, but there's some circumstance that comes up, a legitimate one. And now your yes must now be no, or vice versa. Well, there's an example shared by the Apostle Paul, and it speaks to this kind of thing occurring. Let's go and turn to this 2 Corinthians chapter 1. 2 Corinthians chapter 1. Now, this is a very fascinating passage, particularly in light of Matthew chapter 5, because in it, Paul acknowledges that our yes must be yes, and our no must be no. Yet he employs an oath here to affirm the genuineness of his motivation for changing his plans, because his plans do change. Let's go ahead and pick up in verse 16 of 2 Corinthians chapter 1. He says, "To pass by way of you to Macedonia, to come again from Macedonia to you, and be helped by you on my way to Judea. Therefore, when I was planning this, did I do it lightly? Or the things I plan, do I plan according to the flesh? That with me there should be yes, yes, and no, no? But as God is faithful, our word to you was not yes and no." It was one or the other. Go ahead and skip down to verse 23. He says, "Moreover, I call God as witness against my soul, that to spare you, I came no more to Corinth." So here Paul's explaining to the folks there in Corinth that he had genuinely intended to come to see them, actually twice. First on his way from Ephesus to Macedonia, and then on the return trip. But his plans changed. And the reason he did not come back to Corinth is that he had come to the realization that to do so would have somehow caused them pain or grief. He was there to spare them. You know, was Paul somehow violating then the teaching of Jesus Christ? Was he violating that? I'd like us to turn to James chapter 4. James chapter 4, get a little additional perspective on the issue. There's a principle here that Paul may have been dealing with when he changed his plans. And as we just read, Paul did not come back to Corinth as a return. Again, would have hurt the people in some way. But here in James chapter 4, we actually see a negative example that illustrates the right perspective. James 4, 13 through 17. Actually, we're going to see the sermonette tie into this right here. Verse 13, "Come now, you who say today or tomorrow, we will go to such and such a city, spend a year there, buy and sell, and make a profit. Whereas you do not know what will happen to tomorrow. For what is your life? It is even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills. If the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that." We heard in the sermonette. "But now you boast in your arrogance, and all such boasting is evil. Therefore, to him who knows to do good and does not do it, to him it is sin." So the idea here is that our promises must always be seen through the lens of submitting to God's will, seeking and submitting to that. We may act in good faith to a promise, but as it was mentioned here, we literally may not be able to fulfill it. We don't even know how long we have to live. There could be a promise we've made and we just couldn't do it physically. Couldn't make it happen. Don't have control over that. But rather what's being taught here is that there's a humility in our approach to our commitments and the understanding that we don't have control of the future. And if our promises somehow prevent us from doing the right thing, of doing good, we may need to make a course correction. We may need to do that, as the example of Paul shows us. And again, God in no way is trying to accommodate some sort of a frivolous excuse for us to get out of something for here. But he wants us to be truthful in our promises with the understanding that we always submit to his will and correction, that we're always in that process of looking for that. Paul came to the realization that his visit, again, at least at that particular time, that it wasn't the best thing to do. It caused more harm than good. So he declared before God that what he was doing with the change and his reasoning for it. And he was not going against what was taught regarding yes being yes and no being no. You think about this a little bit. We may need to give one another some latitude. And when it comes to things like that, or things coming up, is this passage telling us to always hold one another's feet to the fire if there's a change? Say, no, you cannot renege your promise. No matter what, we're going to hold your feet to the fire. I'm going to hold you to what is said. Is it telling us to raise doubts about someone's character if they ask for some forbearance from us because they have a conflict, a real conflict with something they intended to do? I think it's pushing us much more into looking at the unseen log in our own eye than is the potential speck in someone else's. Because again, this says, if the Lord wills. If the Lord wills. It's a statement to remember in regards to our promises. And when reading about Paul's situation here, perhaps you can think of examples of your own. Something came to my mind with it many years ago, a couple decades ago. A friend of mine had volunteered to assist me to help run a barbecue for a large group. I have a barbecuer, but the group is huge, so he was going to bring his barbecuer and help me do that. Well, at the last minute, he backed out. Now, he was able to do it physically. He would have been able to do that, but he believed that he was still viral from a cold flu bug he'd been fighting. I bet he sounded terrible on the phone. You know, did he break his promise? Yeah, he did. But did he do the right thing in breaking his promise? I absolutely believe so. Yes, I do. His promise was based on something. His promise was based on doing the best he could, as much as depends on him. But his promise is also based on doing what is best overall. And his coming would have likely caused more harm than good. Could have made a lot of people sick. You know, we're human. We are human. And when we make promises, we, again, have to do so with this very important perspective of if the Lord wills. If we're allowed to do that. I also remember another story. Some friends, again, this happened a long time ago. They had organized a dinner party. At their home, and in this case, they invited two families to come join them after services for dinner, for this dinner party. And interestingly, just the day before, both of those families called and canceled their plans, and said they didn't explain why. They just said something else came up. Well, as a result of these cancellations at services, these folks just planned to invite some other people over. After all, they had prepared a lot of food, thought they could do that kind of thing, but as it turns out, they ended up being offered an invite over to someone else's home instead of going to theirs. So they thought, okay, we'll just put this stuff in the freezer, and when we get home, we'll deal with it later. Well, guess who was at the house they were invited to? Both of the other families they invited. Okay. Yeah, do the words bad form or awkward mean anything to you? Yeah. Okay, so question, was there a promise broken? Yeah. They reneged on their promise. But did the parents of these families do the right thing in backing out of their promise? No. No, they didn't. Very awkward dinner party. Fallout afterwards took a long time for people to really come to a place of, you know, repenting, making apologies, for forgiveness to be given, the sting of the memory of all of it. It was just a hard thing. Anyway, let's go ahead and turn to Luke chapter 16. Luke 16, you know, truth matters. Our yeses matter. Our noes matter. Even when what may seem as small. Smaller things. There's a critical point here that Jesus makes in the parable of the unjust servant that just really speaks clearly to this. I'm going to read this actually from the New Living Translation. This is Luke 16, verse 10. I just really like how this was worded. And it says, if you are faithful in little things, you will be faithful in large ones. But if you are dishonest in little things, you won't be honest with greater responsibilities. And he's teaching here that faithfulness has to be across the board. Faithfulness in everything, all things, all our promises. And if we gave it some thought, I think each of us could probably come up with something or we could assign what we might think as a big faithful thing versus perhaps something that is less than that. But if we were to take, for example, let's just take the marriage covenant. I think we would all agree that it's very much a sacred matter, a big thing. You know, in a wedding, many people refer to the words that are exchanged as marriage vows, which is true. But actually, they can be oaths and vows, promises made between the spouses, and promises made to God. Be both. It's one of the few formal covenants that we practice in our culture. You know, God singles it out over and over again in His Word as a covenant unlike any other. He's the one who declares it to be a picture of the relationship between Christ and His church. He's the one who declares it to be a sacred bond of two into one flesh in His eyes. He's the one that said, what God has joined together, let no man tear asunder. Yet as we read about being faithful in the little things, you know, godliness compels us to honor our statements, even if they seem trivial, even if they seem small. As it relates to the marriage covenant, you know, think for a moment. I'm just going to give some examples here, but you can think of your own. But think for a moment, how will it be if one spouse, you know, let's say you got, okay, both spouses are faithful to the marriage. Let's just start there. But one spouse decides to not quite keep their promises in the smaller things. One of them doesn't. For example, what if they, you know, promise to pick up the kids after school, but they just never quite do that? Or very inconsistently. What if they say that they will agree on your budget so you can save and be a proper fiduciary that way and save money for the, you know, maybe for the kids, for their college, whatever it might be. Let's say they agree on the budget, but, you know, they just don't hold themselves to it. They spend here and there. It doesn't quite happen. What if that was something that was occurring? What if they say they'll spend quality time, but they just don't quite get around to it? What if that is? And how well does it work, this big faithful thing? How well does that work when these little things are not taken care of? That's part of what Christ is teaching here. You can't separate that. Faithful in all things are so important. And he's also saying specifically that the tendency is that people will make light of promises if they perceive them to be small. People have that tendency. And it's also teaching that a godly character, if we have that, we're going to do the right thing. We're going to hold to those promises, even if it's difficult, even if it's inconvenient, even if it's to our own hurt, we'll do that. Let's go and turn to Psalm chapter 15. Psalm 15. And here a question is posed, and it's really the question of who may dwell with the Lord. Who will get to be in the kingdom of God as one of his eternal children? Who has that relationship? And it answers the question of what character the faithful possess. Let's go ahead and pick up in verse 1 of Psalm chapter 15. It says, Lord, who may abide in your tabernacle? Who may dwell in your holy hill? Well, he who walks uprightly and works righteousness and speaks the truth in his heart. Speaks the truth in his heart. It's part of who he is or she is. Let's go ahead and skip down to verse 4. In whose eyes a vile person is despised, but he honors those who fear the Lord. He who swears to his own hurt and does not change. He who swears to his own hurt. You know, in the introduction, we reviewed, you know, some of the court protocols of swearing somebody in. You know, to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth. And we ask this question, does it really make people any more truthful? You know, in a courtroom, for example, might it compel, if someone swore by the Bible or for God, might it compel them who take the stand to think twice about the testimony they give or prompt him or her to endeavor to make good on the promise to tell the truth? You know, perhaps it might. In a courtroom today, it might make someone think twice, but that's besides the point of Jesus' teaching, because he's saying it should make no difference, absolutely no difference at all. No difference. According to God, any formal oath or vow should simply mirror the yes or no that comes from a heart of truth. It comes from that. And so in concluding his statement here, about oaths in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, but let your yes be yes, and your no, no, for whatever is more than these is from the evil one. You know, and as mentioned earlier in the sermon today, some of the scribes and the Pharisees had confused the teaching. Their oaths were no more reliable than the, you know, statement of a child who has his fingers crossed between his back, you know, because in their hearts, they were more interested in being believed than being truthful. More to the point, they are more interested in being believed than being godly. And our yes must be yes. Our yes must be yes and our no, no. No oath can make that so. And in that sense, being believed really is nothing. It's not what's important here. to be believed. Being a truthful person in the eyes of our eternal Father is everything. Truth. And if we were just to read just a little bit farther in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus tells us in verse 48 of Matthew chapter 5 to be perfect, just as your Father in heaven is perfect. And of course, and sometimes you read these things and you read about what these folks did, it's kind of easy to kind of point the finger at them. Wow, just how ridiculous their reasoning was. Glad I'm not like that. Glad I'm different. But the point here is that it's so easy to fall in between the yes and the no. It is so easy to do that. And Jesus tells us that this is a matter of the heart. It is that. Again, our yes must be yes and our no, no. He tells us that we must be and should be people of our word. People who keep promises. People who have at their heart that the truth matters an incredible amount to them. And then they know that it is a demonstration of godly character. A fundamental standard by which we are supposed to live. So in conclusion, I just want to go ahead and read one more verse. In Ephesians 4:15, I'm going to read this from the English Standard Version. And it simply says this: speaking the truth in love, we are to grow up in every way into Him who is the head, into Christ. So brethren, may our yes be yes, our no be no. May we be people who always tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.